Good morning. Thank you for coming. I'd like to ask you to open your Bibles, please, to Genesis chapter 39. We're going to continue our story of Joseph. Joseph is going to take up quite a few chapters here and take us to the end of the book of Genesis, which we hope to get to soon. I think we are on lesson like over 65 now going through Genesis. It's sad that we've now got more CDs than there are chapters in Genesis for this. I apologize for that. Also, we've started this sometime in 2007. So my goal is to at least make it to 2010, then we can wrap it up and say there was a three-year series in Genesis. No one's laughing. Okay. Genesis chapter 39. Joseph is a classic story of an individual who is obedient to God, who follows God. God has given him talents, gifts. He's using them diligently. His father recognizes this even as a 17-year-old child. Joseph is advanced beyond all of his brothers in his place in charge. He's a supervisor, actually he's a shepherd of his brothers, overseeing his brothers as they oversee the sheep. His brothers don't like him. They're jealous of him. They're basically on them, their own personalities, their own character. They, as you know, have sold him into slavery, were willing to kill him. He lives in a very violent family, if you want to call it violent. It's beyond dysfunctional. They've destroyed cities. They've killed people. And they're willing to kill their siblings. Now they've sold him into Egypt. But it says that when he got to Egypt, Yahweh was with him. God was with him. God had a plan. And I think it goes beyond the Abrahamic covenant, because the Abrahamic covenant would apply to all 12 of the brothers. And we've just finished, or a couple weeks, we'll finish chapter 38. We've got an example of Judah, one of the potential leaders of the brothers, who himself actually collapses into deceit and immorality and hypocrisy. Where Joseph, on the other hand, ends up in Egypt, being betrayed, being mistreated, and ends up being purchased as a slave. As we saw last week, as we read through it, I kind of painted the picture, at least, that you see him advancing. You clearly see him advancing, possibly going from the servant's house outside somewhere into being somewhere in the house with Potiphar and his family, to being in charge of Potiphar's house, so that everything that Potiphar had, his owner, one of the rulers there with Pharaoh, one of the military leaders for Pharaoh's army, actually his police force, Joseph is in charge of everything that that man's house. So he's got tremendous favor. We've seen him have tremendous favor with his father, with Potiphar, and we know he's got favor with God. So all things are going good, if you want to consider it good, in Joseph's life, except the fact that he's a slave. I will point out, too, as we went through that last week, it said that he was prospering. That Joseph was prospering. And yet Joseph is a slave. He doesn't own anything. So the prosperity that God was bringing to him was a much richer prosperity than simply possessions and having things. It was success in all areas of his life. So now we've got Joseph, who's in charge of Potiphar's household. And that includes the fact that he's probably overseeing more of a management position, the bookwork and making sure all the other servants are getting things done. So he's not like out, you know, digging in the dirt somewhere as a servant, but he's overseeing all the others from every area of Potiphar's life, to his finances, to his farms, to his government work, to the food he eats. Joseph's overseeing all of these things. Well, here we go with today's story. This could go on forever, and don't you know that sometimes in your life, you get to certain places in your life, it's like, you know what, this is good enough. If we just kind of stayed right here and just live life out at this level, it would be fine with me. But then all of a sudden something happens that's going to take you to the next level or take you to a lower depth. And here we have it right here, chapter 39. I'll begin in verse 6. So he left, Potiphar left in Joseph's care everything he had. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. Now, the story continues. Joseph was well built and handsome. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me." Now, these are two simple Hebrew words, sikba himi. It means lie with me. Just lie with me. That's what it says. She's going to say it twice. The only thing she's going to say here that's going to be quoted is those two Hebrew words. She's going to say it twice. And she says it to Joseph. But Joseph, although she makes a simple request, two simple words, Joseph has not just a no for an answer, but because he's got a quick mind, because he's rational, because he is a leader, he's prepared, he's got a well-rounded answer. Now, here we go. But he refused, and here's what he says. with me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Indicating, yes, I realize I am in charge of everything, but I have a responsibility to my master. He trusts me with everything in his house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. Now again, you can see just in that statement as we reemphasize how high Joseph has gone up. You've got Pharaoh who's in charge of the kingdom, and then you've got his cabinet. And right here, Potiphar is the captain of the guard or captain of the police force. He's the captain of a military standing for Pharaoh. And Joseph is underneath Potiphar. He's a servant nonetheless, but he's got tremendous responsibilities. He says, no one is greater in this house than I am. He's not bragging. He's saying, do you understand? Your husband has entrusted me. No one is greater than me in this house. My master has withheld nothing from me except you. Almost going back to the tree of knowledge of good and evil. You're in charge of the entire garden. Just stay away from this tree. Joseph, you're in charge of everything in this house. Everything I have is under your control. Just stay away from my wife. Because it says, my master has withheld nothing from me except you. And then as if he's teaching her something, because you are his wife. Maybe this doesn't make sense to you, but you are his wife. Maybe I need to explain that to you. And indeed, as we look at this, we put this in a historical setting in Egypt. At this time, around 1800, 1700 BC, there is stories, tales, recordings from Egypt of what we would say adventurous women in the society. This woman right here, as we see what she's saying, it's not like, wow, isn't that strange? It's like, in Egypt, no, not at this time. This is recorded in other places in history, not this story, but in secular writings of women behaving this way in this culture. Well, it goes on and says this, my master has withheld nothing from me except you because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? Now, several things we want to look at here. I've got some verses we want to go take a look at here. But notice right here what Joseph considers this. This is not a sin in his first statement, not a sin against Potiphar, not a sin against society, but he says this is a sin against God. Well, God's not even involved. But because Joseph understands some things, he sees this as a sin against God, against what God has instituted. We come back to those basic principles we've talked about them, individual responsibility, marriage, family, government, nationalism, the foundations of human civilization. When those are undermined, civilization collapses. And marriage must be protected. Marriage must be protected for a variety of reasons, but number one, because it is a sin against God's natural order. If mankind is going to succeed, not just individually, but as a race or as a culture, they have to honor marriage. And Joseph said, this would be a sin against God. I'm violating all kinds of principles that God has. Now, let's go. I got another place I want to take you to here. Go to Proverbs chapter 6, verse 7. I would like to go, and I will here in just a moment, go to Leviticus and Deuteronomy and read a couple of verses there. Because in the law of Moses, again, we don't live under the law of Moses, but the law of Moses does indicate to us some of God's standards. Do you understand what I'm saying? Again, a lot of times that needs to be explained. We don't live under the law of Moses, but the fact that God revealed his will within the law of Moses, there are some things in there that give us an indication of how God has wired the world. For example, adultery. We're going to go back and look at it in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. It is a capital crime. A man who's in the law of Moses, now I'm not advancing this as how we should run our society, but just to get an impression of how strongly God feels about marriage, if a man sleeps with another, in fact, let's go there. Go to Leviticus chapter, we're going to go to Proverbs chapter 6. Leviticus chapter 20, I'm going to look at two verses here. Leviticus and then Deuteronomy. Yeah, this is exciting stuff when you flip over to the book of Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 20. I thought it was going to be boring today, but hey, we're going to Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 20, and it is really, I mean, if we would slow down and teach this, this is some very interesting, exciting verses here. Right here, we're in a chapter of Leviticus chapter 20 where God is revealing and explaining to them basically sexuality, marriage, saying this is right, this is wrong. Again, because the Jews or the Hebrews are about to go in the book of Leviticus, they're about to go into the land of Canaan. That's the goal, the land of Canaan. But the land of Canaan has been overrun with a culture
that is in decline, that have got no boundaries in sexuality. They've got no boundaries in marriage. Their culture has collapsed, and they're about to be driven off the land of the land of promise, or Canaan. And so God is going through Leviticus chapter 20, explaining to them, this is appropriate sexuality. And so we're just looking at one verse here, chapter 20, verse 10. Here we go. If a man commits adultery with another man's wife, with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress must be put to death. In other words, well, that's not that bad of a deal. It's like, everybody does. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's why the Canaanites are being overrun. Everybody's doing it. But here, God's law, if that happens, that needs to be removed from your society immediately, because it is a sign of disaster that's about to come. Well, let's go to Deuteronomy. We're going to see the same thing in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 22. Again, I'm not here trying to apply the law of Moses and these principles to a legal system in America. That'd be another whole discussion, another debate. I'm not beyond using this for reference for a legal system, as our founding fathers did, because there are some very interesting things in here that are very useful that God has revealed. Deuteronomy 22. Deuteronomy chapter 22, verse 22. In fact, I'm going to read a couple verses here. I hope you find it interesting. One of the problems we have, again, just for a reminder, it's like, what are we doing here? What are we talking about this for? One of the problems we have in our society is the ignorance in the church. The church is the light of the world. But because the church is so ignorant, biblically illiterate, they don't have any light to bring to the world. And so this is the kind of stuff that we're just taking a look at, laying a foundation so that you understand the world that God has placed you in, so that you may go off and not be legalistic, not go off and be judgmental, but go off and be a light to the world. Say, adultery is a big deal. It's everybody's doing it. No, really, it is a big deal. It is a bigger deal than maybe anything going down right now in our legislation. Going on to chapter 22, verse 22 of Deuteronomy. If a man is found sleeping with another man's wife, both the man who slept with her and the woman must die. You must purge the evil from Israel. See that? We talked about that last week. Good and evil. Nothing about being nice. Good and evil. This is evil. If you want to define, well, is this good or evil? Well, you got to understand the situation. Now, right here, God says that is evil. What is evil? Evil is something that is in contrast or is coming against God's good, God's plan. And when God establishes foundations for a society and someone comes and begins to undermine those, that's evil. Well, I want to read a couple on here, just to see what's interesting here. If a man happens to meet in a town a virgin pledged to be married, and he sleeps with her, you shall take both of them to the gate of that town and stone them to death. But the girl, because she was in a town and did not scream for help, and the man, because he violated another man's wife, you must purge the evil from among you. Now, if you read the next part, it says, but if out in the country a man happens to meet a girl pledged to be married and he rapes her, only the man who's done this shall die. And the girl doesn't have to be executed, because if she screamed, no one could have helped her anyhow. So no one knows if she screamed. It's just interesting. Not, no real point. They're just interesting. If a woman is in a town and she gets raped, or a man attacks her, and she doesn't scream, why weren't you screaming, honey? And that would be the law of was going to be executed there. Now, watch that. That's dealing with adultery. Just getting a perspective on this. Look in verse 28. If a man happens to meet a virgin who is not pledged to be married, so she's not engaged, she's not married, and rapes her, and they are discovered, what happens now? Now notice, there's no, just to give you a flavor for marriage, how important marriage is. See, we're talking about two different things here. We got sexuality, but we've also got the institution of marriage. In these previous examples, marriage was violated, and both are executed. Here we've just got a breakdown. I don't want to say just a breakdown, but we've got a breakdown in sexuality. A man rapes a girl who's a virgin who's not engaged, or she's not married, and she's discovered. Watch. He shall pay the girl's father 50 shekels of silver. He must marry the girl, for he has violated her. He can never divorce her as long as he lives. Just, you see the perspective right there. There's a sexual violation. Was marriage violated here? Well, there's no marriage. Well, then we'll just fix this. Pay for her, marry her, and you can't get divorced. You've just made the decision for your life. But I don't want it. You want to die? You've just married the girl. Now keep marriage together. You break that marriage apart, now we'll talk. Just, again, indication, not just sexuality, but the value of marriage in the law of Moses. Again, not saying that should be our laws of our land, but I am saying sexuality should be honored and marriage should be honored even more for the well-being of a culture. There's no doubt about that statement. Okay, now, that is just God's law. Now let's go to Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 6 and 7. In Proverbs, the writer of Solomon, who's writing this, the wisdom that David gave to him, he's writing these things down, and he's discussing, again, sexuality, he's discussing adultery, but his reasoning, and this is important, because this is where we've got to get beyond just, why is that wrong? Well, God said so. Next question. It's like, there are reasons. One, we've talked about already, marriage is a foundational foundational in our society. But notice right here, there's nowhere in here, as we talk about adultery in Proverbs in the Book of Wisdom, where Solomon's answer and warning on adultery is, it's a capital crime. You'll die. Don't do it. He's going beyond that. Here we go. Chapter 6, verse 30. He begins in chapter 6 of Proverbs, verse 30, by saying, men do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy his hunger when he is starving. Yet if he is caught, he must pay sevenfold, though it cost him all the wealth of his house. In other words, if a man is starving, if there's no food in the grocery store, and all of a sudden you leave a loaf of bread sitting somewhere on your windowsill or something, and a guy comes up and steals it to go feed his family, it's kind of like, well, he's trying to feed his family. I mean, what do you expect the guy to do? It's still wrong. He's still got to pay seven times, but we understand why he stole the bread. He's trying to stay alive. He's trying to take care of his... It's still wrong. It's still a crime. It's still immoral. It's still going to have to be penalized. He's going to pay sevenfold. But we do understand your logic. You were hungry. Your family was starving. But, in verse 32, in comparison, we do not understand this. There is no excuse for this. There's no like, well, I understand you're in a tough situation. There's when your family's starving and you need food, that is a tough situation. You're still wrong for stealing, but who wouldn't try to protect his family? But here in verse 32, but a man who commits adultery lacks judgment. It's like, this isn't a matter of, well, you got to understand his position. It's like, well, yeah, no judgment skills, no knowledge, no ability to evaluate the situation. Don't go there. But a man who commits adultery lacks judgment. Now watch, it's not going to now give you a bunch of rules because God says it's wrong and you're going to be killed and God will punish you. It's kind of like, you haven't thought through this. If you actually think through this, what are the results? It says, a man who commits adultery lacks judgment. Whoever does so destroys himself. You are going to destroy yourself. Everything that you hold dear, everything that is involved in this, you are about to undermine everything you are and everything you have. Blows and disgrace are his lot, and his shame will never be wiped away. Notice, blows, physical strikes, and disgrace. There will be physical attacks potentially. Well, who's going to attack him? The husband? disgrace. Well, who's going to bring disgrace? The rest of the community who realizes this is a foundation, this is more than just you. This is not just you having an affair. This is you undermining the fabric of our culture. What a disgrace. Now, I know it's like, well, that's not true. People don't think. I know people that have committed adultery and there's no disgrace. Exactly. That's again how far gone we are. It's like, but everybody's doing it. I know people, that's just part of society. Right, that's part of society that's about to be overrun. It's not normal. It's not natural to say, well, you know, it's everybody's doing it. In a normal society that is walking in God's word, someone who commits adultery lacks judgment because he's going to receive blows and he's going to be a disgrace. And his shame will never be wiped away. For jealousy arouses a husband's fury, which explains the blows. And he will show no mercy when he takes revenge. In other words, it's almost guaranteed. It's like the husband should take revenge. There should be something that happens. He will not accept compensation. Like, for example, remember the loaf of bread? Someone steals a loaf of bread. The thief is caught. He's got to pay seven times if that's all you've got. You've got to provide seven times for the bread. You stole one loaf. You've got to bring seven back. But here it says, he will not accept any compensation. So here's the husband who's been offended, and he wants compensation. Well, one loaf of bread will bring you seven. You've got one act of adultery. What are you going to bring in? What are you going to do? Here's seven loaves of bread. I mean, there's nothing you can bring. I mean, you can get creative, but it's like now you've become immoral. You can't fix the problem. He will refuse the bribe, however great it is. This cannot be repaired. Thus, we go back to the law of Moses. Execution is the only thing. This must be removed from your society. So what you see there, you got wounds, loss of respect, public disgrace, a husband's revenge. There's no redemption. These are things that will happen. Go on to chapter 7. We continue on. Chapter 7, verse 1. My son, keep my word and store up my commands within you. Again, you say, well, why are we talking about this? Well, first of all, you remember chapter 38 of Genesis? It was all about Judah and sexual problems. Joseph now is going to go a different direction than Judah. He's going to choose the right decision. He's going to make the right decision, but he's still going to have problems with it. Through Proverbs, all the way through the Bible, this is an issue. Paul addresses it. It's all the way through. It's part of human society. This must be dealt with. Well, here we go. These are the commands, chapter 7 of Proverbs. Look at this, chapter 7, verse 6. Solomon is writing, at the window of my house, I looked out through the lattice. I saw the simple. I noticed among the young men a youth who lacked judgment. Again, remember, anyone who commits adultery, they're not doing it because they're starving. They're doing it because they lack judgment. You don't have enough information. You're not being wise. So Solomon's looking out his window, and he sees down in the streets among the young men, there's one with no judgment skills. He was going down the street near her corner. So it's like they're hanging out there on the corner. He starts to drift off this way, kind of making his way down here towards the corner. It's like, why is he going that way? What's down there? Oh, no, not that corner. Yeah, he's drifting down. Just going down there to check it out. No real plans. Just drifting down to that corner, walking along in the direction of her house. At twilight, as the day was fading, as the dark of the night was setting in. And that all is a reflection, if you want to call it poetic, it's all a reflection of his soul. Further and further away from truth and judgment skills, and closer to the darkness where he cannot make a correct decision. Then out came a woman to meet him. Surprise! Well, what was she doing there? That's her corner. That's her house. He knows where she's at. He just happened to be walking by. She just happened to be waiting for him. Dressed like a prostitute with a crafty intent. Talks she is loud and defiant. Her feet never stay at home. Now in the streets, now in the squares, at every corner she lurks. She took hold of him and kissed him with a brazen face and says, I have fellowship offerings at home. Today I fulfilled my vows. So kind of, I could explain all these things, but we're going to keep moving. So I came out to meet you. I looked for you and I found you. I have covered my bed with colored linens from Egypt. I perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let's drink deep of love until morning. Let's enjoy ourselves with love. My husband is not at home. Don't worry about my husband. He has gone on a long trip. He's on a journey. He won't be home for weeks. He took his purse filled with money and will not be home until the full moon. We're at least a month away before he gets home. With persuasive words, she led him astray. Now notice right here, he's hanging out. Nothing to do. He's walking towards the corner. Pow, she comes out. She's got persuasive words. She's talking faster than he can think. He should be thinking, but he's not. She seduced him with her smooth talk. All at once, he followed her. Okay, now watch right here. This is where it goes negative. Like an ox going to the slaughter. Like a deer stepping into the noose. Till an arrow pierces his liver like a bird darting into a snare, little knowing it will cost him his life. Now that life could be a reference back to the law of Moses. You know, they'll be executed. Or it could be a reference to earlier in Proverbs where everything involved in his life is about to be changed. Now then, my son, listen to me. Pay attention to what I say. Do not let her heart turn to her. Do not let your heart turn to her ways or stray into her paths. Many are the victims she has brought down. Her slain are a mighty throng. Her house is a highway to the grave leading down to the chambers of death. And again, this is several times we could go back to chapter 5 and read more about this, but we're not going to. In other words, why so much literature? And again, we're just scooting across the surface. Because this is very important. Just like individual responsibility, marriage, family, a lot of verses about government, a lot of verses about nationality, nationalism. It's all foundational. To avoid this, to ignore this, is going to put you in a state of ignorance with no judgment skills. One more verse. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Then we'll go back to Genesis and read our story. Joseph said this would be a sin against God. We read Proverbs chapter 6 and 7. It appears if anybody's being sinned against, it's the husband. It's like the husband will take revenge. He'll be settled for nothing. There's no way of paying him back. He has been sinned against. There's nothing. So we've got a sin against God. We've got a sin against the husband. Clearly, we've just in talking, we say it's a sin against society. But now chapter 6 of 1 Corinthians, chapter 6, verse 18. And again, it just point out, this book is filled, 1 Corinthians is filled with this issue. Paul was addressing, he says, you've got to have a wife. One man has one wife. That's all you need, one wife. He says, don't go down to the temple, and we've talked about this before. It's like they had to be taught. Their society had to be taught about marriage. They had to be taught about sexuality. They had no concept of it. They're just declining into paganism. Well, nonetheless, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 18, he says, flee from sexual immorality. All other sins a man commits are outside his body. But he who sins sexually sins against his own body. Joseph says it's a sin against God. Proverbs is addressing the idea there. It's a sin against the husband. We know it's a sin against society. Now, it's a sin against your own body. You are now destroying your own body. He goes on and says this. It's sexually sins against his own body. Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, who you have received from God? You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your body. In other words, the reason you as a believer, you now are saved. You still have your human body, but now the Holy Spirit dwells in your body. And from that point on, you are to use your body, your life, your experiences, everything you have to serve God. Don't be destroying your body with sin. And other things like this. And here he's pointing out sexual sins because, again, that was a problem they were having. We can see many problems there in the church. Chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, if we keep reading, guess what that's about? In my Bible, in just the title they put in the NIV, it's called marriage. You see, right away, again, instructions about marriage. People don't know. They don't know. Well, anyway, we go back to Genesis chapter 39. Let's see how Joseph handles this situation. We have a pretty good idea, I think, what Judah would do. Anyone want to share what they think Judah would do in this situation? Okay, close enough. Okay, Genesis chapter 39, verse 8. She says two words in the Hebrew, sikba himei, which means lie with me. But he refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? He explains, I have everything here. I'm very well trusted. I'm not just a scoundrel. I'm a worthy servant. I'm serving your husband. He trusts me. Your husband trusts me. And you are his wife. It almost needs to explain that to her. And then says, I would be sinning against God. The entire fabric of God's society would be undermined by this act. And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. Now, here's a great example. She's wearing him down. First attack was just go out and ask. Next is just a bombardment day after day. Now, Josephus records this same event, and he's going to have some more details coming up here. But as we look at this historically, what she's doing is she's made herself available. She said, this is what I want. And she continues to hammer. And he's got to fight this battle. Of all the other things he's got going on in his life, he now has this that he's got to deal with. Every day he's got to plan. Where is she going to be? Can't be there. He's got to make sure that he's avoiding this. And she's going out of her way to make contact. And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her, but more than that, or to even be with her. She probably took it down a step. Well, maybe we could just get lunch. Maybe we could just kind of, I could help you do your book work. Maybe I could just, and he won't even, nothing, cuts nothing, don't even want to be with her. Verse 11. One day, he went into the house to attend to his duties. So what she's had so far, she's come at him, first of all, with the ideal of making the request. Then she's tried wearing him down, and now there's a plan. Now, what Josephus records, you don't have to accept this. This is just what Josephus adds about the story, part of the Jewish tradition of the story, which I have no reason to doubt that it wasn't true. But on this particular day, there was an Egyptian feast where it was a very solemn holiday and everyone would go out. It was a feast for the women mainly, but everyone would go out and the woman would participate in this solemn religious festival. Joseph didn't participate because he's in charge of the house. Probably there's other servants possibly in the house possibly. But all the Egyptians are out. The woman, the wife of Potiphar, according to Josephus, claimed to be sick. She couldn't go participate in the solemn feast, so she stays home. And there's where she's at. And that lines up well with the story. Because here we find the situation where Joseph is going to be alone with her in the house for some reason. This is a unique situation because day after day she spoke with him, but there always seemed to be people around or situations that they weren't always alone. She's now created a situation. One day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. So they're around, not necessarily at the feast, but not inside. He's doing the duties. He's in Potiphar's house. He's living in Potiphar's house. It's where he's working. She caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." That's the same two Hebrew words. She says it a second time. But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. Now, the idea of the cloak, it brings us back to the idea that he had a coat of many colors that was taken from him, and now he's got a coat here. It's like these coats keep getting him into trouble. The first thing, when he becomes Pharaoh's assistant, they're going to want to give him a coat. It's like, no coat, thank you. But the coat right here, it's translated a variety of ways throughout the New or Old Testament. It's some part of clothing. It may be just his outer cloak or a coat. It may be, some have said it's a shirt. Some have said it's an undergarment of some sort. But she got a hold of something and pulls it from him. Now, and she makes her request. And he left his cloak in her hand and ran away. Again, he wouldn't even refuse to be with her. Now he's doing exactly what Paul tells Timothy to do, what David told Solomon to do, flee. When you see this, flee. You understand this next comment. There's no fighting this. There's no hand-to-hand combat. There's no in-the-face competition. It's like you only beat this by running from it. If you stay and talk with it, you're going to lose. If you stay and try and combat it, you're going to lose. Run away from it. Well, he knows. I can't stay here and fight this. And flees, runs away. Again, good judgment skills. He's already planned everything. He knows what is going on. He flees. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. So again, we know there's some servants around. Now, realize right here, she's got a situation. Joseph is running out of the house. She's got his coat, and someone's going to say something. Either she's got to get the coat back, or you know, it's going to come down to she said, he said type of thing. So she's going to make sure she says before he says. Because there's a situation now. And I want you to notice, I'm going to read through the list here first of all. There's in these next three or four verses, there are 12 things she's going to do to paint him into a very negative light. Here we go, very quickly. We're going to read through these in just a minute. One, the cloak is evidence. She's going to use the cloak as evidence of his intent. Number two, she's going to tell the household servants. First, she's going to tell the household servants. Before her husband gets home, she's going to call the household servants, and she's going to tell them what happened. So in other words, she's going to rehearse the story. She's going to start telling the story. This is what happened. She's going to then start the rumor mill. So by the time Potiphar does walk in the house, there's already talk about what they saw happen. And in a sense, she's going to be preparing her witnesses. They didn't see anything, but they already know the story. And so they're talking, well, who told you that? They told me this. Well, they were there. And now she's creating witnesses. They're not witnesses, but she's creating the illusion of witnesses. Next, she's going to call him a Hebrew. She's not going to call him Joseph. She's going to call him a Hebrew, which refers to him as a foreigner, which is in a negative light. Now, foreigners, again, were welcome in this culture. Egyptians were not at this time, in this culture at this time, were not racist. We can see that even up to the days of Moses. Moses, the Hebrew, is brought into the Pharaoh's house and raised as his own until he's 40 years old. And they know he's a Hebrew, but that doesn't matter. What they were interested in is not race, but culture. You could be a Hebrew as long as you lived like an Egyptian, as long as you had the Egyptian culture. And when Joseph's brothers see Joseph, they don't see a Hebrew, because they're all similar-looking people. They see an Egyptian because he's accepted the Egyptian culture. Moses, when he goes into the land of Midian, the daughters go and tell their father Jethro, we were saved by the Egyptian. They don't say the Hebrew. They call him an Egyptian. He looked like an Egyptian. So again, in this culture, there were foreigners, but the foreigners even married Egyptians. But they would, of course, have to become Egyptian in their culture. So it's not a racial statement, but it's still a statement about a foreigner, calling him a Hebrew. Number next, she's going to talk about brought to us when she talks to the servants. He was brought to us. We didn't do anything to deserve this. This man was brought to us. He makes sport of us. She's going to say that phrase right there. Tell the household servants, he is brought to us, not our doing. Someone brought him to us to make sport of us. And you've got to assume she's really kind of smart. Well, she's brilliant in this area. She knows that if he's in charge, there's got to be some kind of jealousy. Someone's offended, which they got the position. There's someone that he's corrected, someone he's moved out of position to make it. Did his brothers love him? His brothers hated him because he did what was right. And so there's got to be some household servants who don't like Joseph. So what she says to the household servant, she's going to say, he was brought here to make sport of us. He's using you to his advantage. And that's going to rise up even a little less favorable sentiment towards him. She's going to say, I screamed. Remember how important screaming was. I screamed, which clearly indicates it wasn't. If it was my idea, why would I be screaming? Meaning, again, it's not my fault. I was the one trying to stop it. The scream is very important. And you got to believe they all heard it. Probably several extra screams to make sure it was recorded correctly. He left his cloak. She's going to say, he left his cloak, not I took his cloak. Meaning, if he left his cloak, that means he took his cloak off and left it laying here, right here. She's also going to leave it there and wait. She's not going to disturb the crime scene. She's going to probably stay where she was, leave the coat, or maybe reposition a little bit, so that when Potiphar comes home, he can hear the talk, he can hear the rumors, he can see the yellow police tape, and he comes in and there she is, right, the crime scene. Everything's still there for him to, just like Joseph, or when Joseph was sold, they brought the coat that was torn of his, that was all filled with the animal's blood, and they just let Jacob make the decision. Here's what do you think happened? She's going to leave it all right there. What do you think happened? And he's going to make his own conclusion. We're going to read this out here in just a minute. But she's going to tell her husband Potiphar, you brought him to us. You brought him to us. How irresponsible. You put this animal in a house with me. You brought this man into us. So now Potiphar, well, yeah, but honey, I was trying to do what I didn't know. But now it's out Potiphar's head's on the line. She's now accusing Potiphar. You brought him to us. You brought him in among us like a wild dog to make sport of me. Now she tells the servants to make sport of us, all of you. He's using all of you. But to her husband, she knows that he's not going to, Joseph's not making sport of Potiphar. He's been running his business. He's been running everything. She says, now he's here to make sport of me. Who do you want, your servant or me? And finally, she says, your slave, and refers to how he treated her. So let's read this. Just listen to those 12 things in these words that she's going to say this very short time. Verse 13. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. Look, she said to them, this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he knew you were coming to help. He left his cloak beside me that he had taken off and ran out of the house. So now, oh, and so they probably called 911. They got everybody active there, police tapes all set up, newspapers there reporting it. Potiphar comes home and walks in, and there it is, right there. She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home so he can see it. Then she told him this story. That Hebrew slave, Hebrew slave, you brought us, came into me to make sport of me. Do you understand who's really at fault here? What do you expect from a wild dog? Why would you bring a wild dog into the house anyhow? A wild dog is going to act like a wild dog. But now here I am, your refined wife, and this wild dog. How did he get in the house? You brought him. I want you to get rid of the wild dog. So, okay, now who's on defense now? Poor Potiphar. That Hebrew slave you brought us came into me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, thank goodness I had enough sense to scream. Otherwise, who knows what could have happened? Screamed for help. He left his cloak beside me, as you can see laying right here, and ran out of the house. That is the story. None of it's true, but all of it makes sense. You wonder, though. Now listen, I'm just going to read into this a little bit right here. Joseph's going to go to jail. But what does the law of Moses say should happen to a man like this? Execution. Now this man's not even a citizen. This man's a servant. This man's a slave. He was bought for a price. You get rid of him. Why? What should Potiphar do? What is the obvious result that Potiphar should do right here? There should be an execution, an instant execution of this servant. But Potiphar doesn't do that. He puts him in prison. Also, notice this right here. When his master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, "This is how your slave treated me." He burned with anger. Now, the Hebrew and the English say just like that. When he heard the story, he burned with anger. And I think it's very safe to assume he's burning with anger against Joseph for what Joseph did. But there is room within this right here. He burned with anger because he knows that's not true. I mean, do you think he knows his wife? I mean, do you think she's, well, you understand. Do you think he knows his wife? And he hears this story. The servants are all around. The police are already there. The evidence is here. And he knows. So possibly, at least it's a thought, Joseph should be executed. But instead, Joseph's master took him and put him in prison. He took it. He went himself. He went and got him and put him in prison. It just seems a light penalty for all the big episode here. And notice the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were kept or confined. Now, the king's prisoners would be political enemies. Whenever, and we're going to see it coming up right here, the cupbearer and the baker, they're going to be in the same confinement. And they are there because someone's guilty, but we're not sure who it is. So we're going to confine you. It's almost like a holding bin. And then the decision, as the story's going to go on here in chapter 40, the decision is going to be found out. One of them was guilty of a conspiracy against Pharaoh. He'll be executed, which means the other one was innocent and is going to be restored to his position. So this confinement is clearly, in this next chapter, is a place of holding until the judgment can be made. And in the next chapter, one is going to be executed, one is going to be restored. Joseph's in that same prison. Just telling you, Potiphar's not a fool. His wife is lying. He probably knows his wife. He has seen what Joseph has done. But he is in a position where there's nothing. He may have caught it hook, line, and sinker. He may say, "That's right, honey, it's my fault. I'm going to have this man locked up in prison for the rest of his life." Okay, that's what Americans do. In the real world, they execute people like this. You see what I'm saying? We're all American. Well, yeah, that's a just judge. We'll just put him in prison, give him a weight machine and a video player and three meals a day. And that'll teach him. He'll never work here again. He'll just sit there and watch TV and work out and play cards with his friends. See, that's like, you understand what I'm saying. This makes no sense in the Egyptian world to take a man like this and confine him to prison. So I'm just saying that. Here we go. Well, okay, here that's the end of that story. Potiphar's set Joseph away. Everything's fine and dandy in his house again. He's got to find something. He's got to go back to work now. He probably didn't want to send Joseph away. Probably hoping there's some kind of evidence comes out. Maybe get a new wife. I hate to lose Joseph. I'll get a new wife. But while Joseph was there in the prison, here it is, the Lord was with him. Now, my friends, what Joseph has just gone through, you can understand why the Lord continues to be with him. Joseph fears the Lord. He fears him so much that he's going to do what's right, even if it costs him. And when he ends up in prison, yes, he's in prison as an accused slave, but the Lord is with him. But while Joseph was in prison, the Lord is with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison. And he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. So now Joseph's prospering as an accused slave in prison. And Joseph prospers because he continues to do what's right. Doing what's right is not going to be easy. People are not always going to appreciate it or like it or even agree with it, because they don't know what's good and evil. They want evil. Many times people want evil. But if you're like Joseph, continue to do good, things are not going to be all smooth and honky-dory, but I can guarantee it, when you're in the caravan going to Egypt, having your ankles bruised with the shackles, Yahweh will be with you. When you're sold as a slave, Yahweh will be with you. When you're accused and put in prison, Yahweh will be with you. And you'll find success as a slave in a caravan. You'll find success as a slave in your master's household. You'll find success in the prison. And ultimately, as we continue this story, it's going to end up wonderfully. By the time we get up here to chapter 41, Joseph's going to be given his own wife. She's going to be given the wife of a priest. Meaning, he's going to be working for the Pharaoh as the number one man in Egypt and marrying into the priestly line. Unbelievable. Unbelievable how things are going to turn around for him. Now again, does Joseph know all this? No, he doesn't know this. He just fears God. He just knows, well, it's better to be here and have the Lord with me or have done it the other way and have God abandon me. And we continue the story here later, but again, we can see very clearly as this story continues to unfold, Joseph is making difficult decisions. But Proverbs have said, the man without judgment, the man without wisdom, the man without knowledge will follow these disastrous ways like an ox to the slaughter, like a bird stepping in a net, because they don't have any judgment skills. Understand, there is a sin nature, folks. We all have a sin nature. But one of the things that helps overcome the sin nature is the fear of God and the establishment of truth in your soul. So that as you look at the options of good and evil, you can discern and say, well, this is evil, yes, but it's still going to be what I want to do. Yeah, but do you see the results of this? Oh, well, then I don't want to do it. And that is a motivation. You might call yourself a saint. Say, well, I'm just a saint. I'm not tempted. I just do things right. Well, congratulations. But I think the biblical concept of a saint or someone who is able to walk in goodness and follow God is one who looks at evil, realizes the desire and the temptation of evil, but can judgmentally see and come to a conclusion this is going to lead to destruction. And they will not go this way, not because they got such a great nature about them and they always do what's right. It's like, nope, don't want to go that way. I'm going to go this way, the way of success. I mean, it comes down, there's many reasons for doing what's right. But it's got to be, most of the time, more than just say, well, God's going to hit me with a bolt of lightning if I don't do what's right. There's got to be some kind of consequence you can see. Joseph had the foresight to see, no, I don't want to go there. Solomon, of course, now we go the other way. Solomon's the one who wrote the book, and yet he's going to follow this. Sin nature's going to end up taking him down there anyhow. Just ask yourself, what would Joseph do? What would Judah do? Judah went down this way. Simeon and Levi went down this way. Joseph, of course, is going to stay this side, and things are going to continue to work out for him. Well, let's pray and we'll be dismissed. Father, we come to you today in the name of Jesus. We do thank you for the chance to gain wisdom, to gain insight, to understand the things that you value, that you have reasons for the things that you hold to be fabrics of our society. And we ask that we may be people who are light, who understand them, who have the ability and foresight to make decisions based on your truth, being able to anticipate the results before they happen. Father, do thank you for the examples of Joseph and know that you are with us, that you give us the same potential that you gave Joseph as far as walking with us and trusting us with things and rewarding us. We ask that we again may show you faithfulness in our own abilities. In Jesus' name we pray.